It's a Web Wisdom edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, health triage and the cold, sleep and the flu shot, SciShow Space, and how old is life, planetary alignment and the future of the sun and the earth, test tube, and profit for prisons, mandatory vaccination, defining terrorism and the difference between Sunnis and Shiites, and what is a coup d'etat, and lastly, it's okay to be smart with there is no cold, deja vu, and why clouds don't fall. Let's begin episode 283.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Okay, this first set is from Healthcare Triage. A link can be found on the Listen Now page of our website. It's winter, well, in the rest of Canada. And with that comes cold and flu season. What do we need to know? Let's sit back and listen.
Is there a mother out there who doesn't warn their children that going out in the cold is going to make them sick? Do you think that drinking alcohol will warm you up? Myths about cold weather are the subject of this healthcare triage. Myth. Going out in cold weather makes you more likely to get sick. What's up with this belief? Do people think that the cold hurts our immune system and makes us more susceptible to getting sick? Because the opposite seems to be true. In a small study of how the body's immune system reacts to cold exposure, scientists actually found that the immune system was stimulated when people were exposed to the cold. The cold increased the number and the activity level of some of the body's key sickness-fighting cells, things like leukocytes, granulocytes, natural killer cells, and other chemicals necessary to fight off infection. So, cold weather actually may help your body to fight getting sick. So why do people seem to get sick more in the winter? Well, one explanation is that people spend more time indoors when it's cold outside. They stay in relatively close proximity to each other. That allows them to pass colds and other viruses around with their sneezing and coughing. So staying inside may actually make things worse. Myth. Bundling up makes it less likely that you'll get a cold. There are days even I'm amazed at what gets studied. To the research. In a study published back in 1958, volunteers were divided into two groups. One group had to sit in very cold conditions, but were allowed to wear warm coats. A second group had to sit in their underwear in 60-degree temperatures. And a third lucky group hung out in a balmy 80 degrees of warmth. Then all of them had a sick person's mucus dripped into their nose. Yes, maybe someday you'll be lucky enough to enjoy a glamorous career in science. Anyway, it turns out that it didn't matter at all how cold it was or what you were wearing. Everyone with the virus stuck into their nose had the same risk of getting sick. The temperature and what you were wearing made no difference at all. Myth. Going out wet makes you more likely to get a cold. Again, I'm not condoning this research, but let's go to it anyway. In 1968, a study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at inmates in Texas prisons. They were put in all kinds of temperatures and all kinds of dress. They were even put in water baths at near freezing temperatures. And then, cold virus was put into their noses. And it made no difference at all. Infection rates were similar no matter how damp you were. Wetness and wet hair makes you no more likely to get sick. Now, there was a similar study that was published in 2005 in the Journal of Family Practice. They randomized 180 people to either go about their business or have their feet placed in water at 10 degrees Celsius for 20 minutes. And that's all. No infections were introduced. Later, it turned out that those who had their feet chilled were more likely to report cold symptoms later on. Some touted this as evidence that cold, wet feet made you more likely to get a cold. But this study didn't look at infection, it looked at reported symptoms. It could be that people just noticed their runny nose more because they remembered how cold their feet were and were terrified about getting sick. There's no evidence to prove you're more likely to get a cold from letting a part of you get wet and cold. Yeah, the older studies are, well, older. But they're exactly how you'd design a trial if you wanted to test this hypothesis. Look, I don't know who'd volunteer to have mucus put in their nose, but they went ahead and did it. Let's take their work and accept it. Myth. Drinking alcohol warms you up. Okay, let's start with those St. Bernards running around with casks of alcohol around their neck. First of all, do they think people get lost in the Alps with mugs? And why barrels? Why not a blanket? First aid kit, maybe materials to start a fire? Plus, it's a total myth that drinking alcohol warms you up. Alcohol lowers the vasoconstriction threshold and leaves you vasodilated. In other words, you get more blood rushing to your skin. This might make you feel warmer in the very short run, but in the long run, it does the opposite. All that blood exposed to the cold means that it gets cooled off. That lowers your core body temperature. It doesn't raise it. And of course, there's research. A study published in the British Journal of Clinical Practice in 1995 got a bunch of men to drink either alcohol or placebo and then immersed them in cold water for an hour. When they drank the alcohol, their temperatures went down more, by a bit. A similar study published the next year tried to quantify this effect. It also found that drinking alcohol led to a lower overall core temperature. But again, the difference was pretty small. They concluded that the idea that drinking might lead to hypothermia, which many also think is a real thing, is likely also untrue. But there's no evidence for alcohol warming you up, and some minimal evidence for it doing the opposite. Myth busted. There's been a lot about vaccines in the news recently, especially the flu vaccine. So we're going to concentrate on that in Healthcare Triage News. Unless you've been living under a rock, you've seen some headlines about how the flu shot this year is only 23% effective. Most of the headlines are panicky and angry. I don't know why. Let's start with a simple explanation of what it means that this year's flu shot is 23% effective. What happens is that the CDC monitors people coming to doctor's offices with acute respiratory infections and checks them for influenza by laboratory testing. It then checks the proportions who were vaccinated or unvaccinated. Then they calculate effectiveness as 100% times 1 minus the odds of being vaccinated among those with influenza over the odds of being vaccinated among those without influenza. And this is what they found. Of those with influenza, about 49% were vaccinated. Of those without influenza, about 56% were vaccinated. Converting those to odds gets you 0.957 for influenza-positive people and 1.283 for influenza-negative people. So effectiveness equals 100 times, parentheses, 1 minus, parentheses, 0.957 over 1.283, close both parentheses, equals about 25%. But that's unadjusted. So the CDC did some adjusting, and it's 23%. But let's remember the reality here. First of all, the differences in the percentages were 49% of those with flu were vaccinated versus 56% of those without flu were vaccinated. That's a bad year. In a good year, say 2013, the numbers were 32% and 56%. And that yields an effectiveness of 62%. But even in a good year, a third of people who were influenza positive were vaccinated. My concern here is that people, and a lot of people in the media, have a rather poor understanding in general of what effective means when it comes to healthcare. For instance, people assume that a good flu shot is a lock against not getting the flu. The CDC reported isn't a randomized controlled trial, and I'm not going to try to calculate the NNT, and you better have watched that video. It's also not a perfect methodology to establish how the influenza vaccine reduces the absolute probability of your getting the flu. But the differences between this year and others just really aren't as huge as many are saying they are. And it's just a shot. It's hard to see how the benefits don't still massively outweigh the harms, especially since we do have randomized controlled trials. To the research. A meta-analysis of 17 flu shot studies showed that when the vaccine is well-matched, 1.2% of vaccinated people were infected with influenza versus 3.9% of people not vaccinated. That makes the number needed to treat, or NNT, for a well-matched flu shot to prevent one influenza infection to be 37. When the match is poor or uncertain, however, the NNT is 77. A couple of points here. First of all, NNTs of 37 and 77 are pretty good, especially for something like a shot. The NNT for many, many, many other things we consider no-brainers are much higher. Also, 37 and 77, while different, aren't so different that we'd tell you to do one but not the other. They're both in a class that would be recommended. It's important to understand that even if you're vaccinated, you can still get the flu. It's not like your chance went from 90% to 1%. No matter what, you still need to practice good hygiene. Wash your hands. Stay home if you're sick. Don't sneeze or cough on others. common sense stuff. My issue here is that many are treating the news of this year's flu shot as if there's some monstrous difference from other years, and that we should behave differently this year than other years, and that's just not the case. The difference between 60% effective and 23% effective is subtle. It's real, but not that huge. Yes, you should get a flu shot, because the NNT is still pretty great. Herd immunity is important, but you should always, always practice good infection control as well. Sleep. It's probably the one single thing we spend the most time doing. If you do it 8 hours a night, it means that you spend literally one third of your life asleep. Most of us are getting less than that, and we probably need more. Sleep is important. It's also the topic of this healthcare triage. So how do you figure out how much sleep people need? These days, it's hard to know. After all, modern society has changed how and when we sleep. We have electrical lights that allow us to be productive at night. We have coffee to wake us up in the morning. You'd have to return people to a simpler life to find out how much sleep is natural. You gotta love scientists. They did just that. They got five healthy adults to live in a Stone Age-style settlement for 8 weeks in southern Germany. No electricity, no running water, no internet or modern conveniences. They slept on brushwood and furs. They had no alarm clocks. They had only a campfire for light at night. Germans, man. And what happened? Before the study, the five adults fell asleep on average at 11:42 p.m. But under Stone Age conditions, they went to bed at 9:37 p.m. After the experiment, they went back to their old habits, falling asleep at 11:07 p.m. Waking time didn't change as much. Before the experiment, they woke up at about 7:02 a.m. In Stone Age conditions, they woke up at 6:28 a.m., and afterwards they went back to 7:14 a.m. Sleep time increased too. They went from an average of 5 hours and 42 minutes before the experiment to 7 hours and 12 minutes in Stone Age conditions, then back to 5 hours and 13 minutes after. So they weren't sleeping naturally outside of the experiment, but the natural amount wasn't 8 hours. It was about 7.25 hours. The National Sleep Foundation published a survey of people's sleep habits in 6 countries. Canadians and Mexicans sleep the most at 7.1 hours a night, then Germans at 7 hours, and citizens of the UK at 6.8 hours. At the bottom were the US at 6.5 hours, and Japanese at 6.4 hours. People are also sleeping less than they used to. In the early 40s, almost 85% of Americans got 7 hours or more of sleep. By the 1990s and continuing to today, less than 70% of people get that much sleep. Richer people also get more sleep than poorer people. Only about a third of people in the United States making $75,000 a year or more get less than 6 hours of sleep at night. On the other hand, almost half of people making less than $30,000 a year get less than 6 hours a night. We also sleep pretty inefficiently. We spend too much time in bed not sleeping. We're watching TV or surfing the internet. We're drinking at night. We even exercise before bed, and all of these things make it less likely that we're going to sleep efficiently. Kids generally need more sleep, and it's easier to try to figure out how much babies need to sleep because we let them be. The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute recommends that newborns get 16 to 18 hours of sleep at night. Lots of them get that because, again, we let them. Only a fool wakes a sleeping baby. I've had 3 of them, and I'm telling you that's the case. Preschool age kids are recommended to get 11 to 12 hours of sleep at night, and fewer get that. School age children should get at least 10 hours of sleep at night, and they don't. And teens usually need 9 to 10 hours a night, and lots of them don't get that. The median 3-year-old gets about 11 hours of sleep in the United States. The median 8-year-old gets about 10 hours of sleep. The median teenager gets about 9 hours of sleep. That means about half of all these kids are getting less sleep than they likely need, especially the teens. And not getting enough sleep can lead to some bad and often strange consequences. But those are the topic of next week's healthcare triage, so let's put that off for now. This week, I'd like to end by focusing on some recent news that getting too much sleep might be bad for you. The Wall Street Journal had an article this summer entitled, Why 7 hours of sleep might be better than 8. It highlighted a study published in JAMA Psychiatry in 2002 entitled Mortality Associated with Sleep Duration and Insomnia. The study followed more than 1 million people with cancer. They found that people who slept between 6.5 and 7.5 hours a night on average had a lower mortality rate than those who slept more. The article also noted some research that showed that people who slept more than 7 hours a night had lower cognition scores as well. But correlation is not the same as causation. You can't forget that it's entirely possible that sicker people might have needed more sleep and gotten it. In other words, it's possible that being sick leads people to sleep more instead of more sleep leading to illness. But all of this misses the point. People likely need very different amounts of sleep. A recent New Yorker article summarized much of the research on sleep and genetics and posited that about 80% of the variation of people's need for sleep is genetic. So maybe you're not getting enough sleep. If you're getting less than 6 to 7 hours a night, that's probably not enough. But if you feel great and you're doing well, don't sweat it. Don't force yourself to get more just because of some published average.
This Jan-cember, keep yourself warm with our double deluxe issue of Discorder. Get yourself caught under the mistletoe with our special cover article on Rec Center. Ring in the new year with features on Vancouver art spaces and the heroes of Shindig.
Please remember to solemnly celebrate January solstice in a traditional way with articles on Candela Farm and Witch of the Waste.
So please check out the Jan-cember issue of Discorder, and we'll see you again in February.
Lorem ipsum, lorem ipsum.
Special thanks go out to our advertisers of this issue: LiveVan.com, Vinyl Records, Rickshaw, The Fox Cabaret, AMS Events, Audio Pile, Light Organ Records, Extra Living, Sad Mag, Flemish Eye, and the Presentation House Theater.
And we're back. This next set is from SciShow Space, also linked on the website. Let's get a bigger perspective on life.
When we talk about the search for life elsewhere in the universe, we almost always talk about it in terms of where. Like where other habitable planets might be, and how far they are from their stars, and whether we could ever reach them. All that stuff is fun to think about. But some scientists are investigating the issue of extraterrestrial life by asking a different question. When? Because even if life has developed on other planets, it may not have shown up at the same time as it did here. Let's start with what we know. Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and the fossil record shows that the first hints of simple single-celled organisms appear around 3.7 billion years ago. Over time, life forms became increasingly complex, with the first signs of multicellular organisms showing up in fossils that are around 1 billion years old. Since then, life has grown in complexity at an exponential rate, creating the diversity that we see today. In fact, a pair of theoretical biologists, Alexei Sharov and Richard Gordon, recently calculated that the genetic complexity on Earth has been doubling every 376 million years. That means that today, there's twice as much unique information encoded in the genomes of living things as there was 376 million years ago, and four times more than 752 million years ago, and so on. And this got the scientists to wondering, what if they extrapolated their trend backward? If the genetics of living things doubled in complexity every 376 million years, then when would the very first, simplest form of life have appeared? Much to their surprise, they found that, mathematically speaking, the first genetic ancestor to all life on Earth should have existed 9.5 billion years ago. 5 billion years before Earth actually formed. Now, the scientists point out that there are explanations for this. Like, it's possible that life on Earth grew more complex more quickly in the past than it does now, which would account for their results. But still, it raises the question, what if life, as a thing, in the universe, is older than our planet itself? Sharov and Gordon aren't the only ones thinking about when life began. Astrophysicist Avi Loeb recently calculated that what we think of as the general formula for life, liquid water, chemical compounds like methane and ammonia, and a rocky planet to serve as the cosmic mixing bowl, could have all formed more than 13.5 billion years ago, as early as 10 million years after the Big Bang. At that point in time, Loeb figures there were probably some planets, most likely rogue planets, not bound to any star, formed from the cast-off debris from the very earliest stars in the universe that had already exploded. And those planets wouldn't have even needed nice, balmy orbits around a friendly star to get the spark of life out of their chemical mixtures. That's because the universe started off extremely hot and has been cooling ever since. So at some point, he says, the average temperature of the universe was in the right range for those rogue planets to have liquid water on their surface. Nutty, I know. But studies like these suggest that life could be older than we think. think, and that it could naturally spread from place to place around the universe, a theory known as panspermia. According to this theory, impacts could blast material off the surface of a planet, and that debris could carry with it the ingredients for life. And if it kicked out fast enough, some of that material could eventually end up on other planets. In this scenario, simple components of life from rogue planets could have been mixed in with the material that our solar system formed from billions of years ago. So, I'm not saying it's aliens. No, seriously, people, I'm not saying that life on Earth was brought here by aliens. What I'm saying is that panspermia is one potential explanation for why the trends of genetic complexity that we see suggest that life on Earth could be older than the planet itself. Now, this theory doesn't explain where those components came from in the first place, and it doesn't mean that life is necessarily abundant in the universe, because a seed still needs to find fertile soil in order to sprout, right? So it could still be that life we have here on Earth is rare, maybe even unique within our larger celestial neighborhood. What these new studies suggest is just that the best question may not be, are we alone in the universe? It may be more like, are we the first advanced life in the universe? Or are we just the most recent link in a chain of life that dates back to the early universe? If you're at all like me, you enjoy the sun and are a big fan of its work. We all depend on our nearest star to keep Earth at just the right temperature to sustain life. And that just right temperature is a function of the sun's luminosity. People often use luminosity as a synonym for brightness, but that's not really what it is. Luminosity actually describes the total amount of energy released by a celestial object every second. Now, it may not surprise you that the sun hasn't always had the same luminosity that it has now, and I'd rather you hear this from me than anyone else. It definitely won't stay the same in the future. There, there. I know. Currently a middle-aged 4.5 billion-year-old star, the sun will spend the next 7.7 billion years getting bigger, hotter, brighter, cooler, changing color, and eventually transforming into a white dwarf, all while doing its best to destroy the Earth. At which it may or may not succeed, we're not really sure. I mean, as a chunk of rock hurtling through space, Earth might survive all the sun's upcoming shenanigans. But us and everything that's alive on it, not so much. Let's start with the sun that we know and love today. It's currently what's known as a main sequence star, which means that it's fusing hydrogen into helium in its core. Not all stars do this, and the sun won't do it forever. As the sun ages, its core fills up with helium that it can't fuse. And as the helium builds up, the core starts to shrink, which makes it burn even hotter. As a result, the sun starts burning through its hydrogen more quickly. That extra heat from the fusion going faster trickles out through the outer layers of the sun, called its envelope. And all this rising heat gradually makes our star larger, hotter, and more luminous. This whole process I'm talking about is going on right now in the sun, but extremely slowly. Today, the luminosity of the sun is increasing by about 1% every 100 million years. If you do the math, you'll realize that after 1 billion years, the luminosity of the sun will have increased by over 10%. It might not sound like much, but trust me, it's enough to put a real hurtin' on the Earth. A 10% increase in the sun's luminosity will make the Earth so hot that the oceans will start evaporating. And it won't end there. Water vapor, like CO2, is a greenhouse gas, so all that extra water vapor in the atmosphere will set off a runaway greenhouse effect. As the planet warms, the oceans will evaporate faster, putting even more water vapor into the atmosphere, which will warm the planet faster still. It's a classic case of positive feedback, and it'll keep going until the oceans boil away completely. So, not only will there not be any liquid water on future Earth, but the molecules of that evaporated water will also find their way to the upper atmosphere. There, the sun's ultraviolet radiation will break off atoms of hydrogen, which will be permanently lost to space. With the hydrogen gone, the water molecules will never be able to reform, and the Earth will dry out. Permanently. So, let's get this out of the way right now. Even if humans have managed to stick around by this time, the changes in the sun will render Earth completely uninhabitable in about a billion years. So, you know, start planning accordingly. But the sun will still have a long way to go before it reaches the end of its lifespan. And even though it won't be habitable, Earth might still exist, at least for a while. Because at this point, the sun is just beginning to get bigger and more luminous. It won't be until 5.5 billion years from now that the sun will run out of hydrogen in its core and end its main sequence lifetime. That doesn't mean it'll be totally out of hydrogen. There just won't be any in its core. but there'll be a ton of fuel left in the region around the core. And that reserve of fuel will keep on fusing, marking the beginning of the next phase of the sun's evolution. A shell of fusing hydrogen around the sun's core will start pumping massive amounts of heat into the sun's envelope. And just like a hot air balloon, the hot gas in the envelope will expand. This will make the sun expand very rapidly. And although the core will be hotter than ever, because the sun has expanded so much, its surface will be a lot cooler, around 3,000 Kelvin. Combine the increasing size and cooler surface, which by now has turned from white to red, and you get a giant red star that experts call a red giant star. In this phase, the sun's luminosity and radius will continue to grow faster and faster until, in about 7.2 billion years, things get crazy fast. By this time, the sun will have become over 2,000 times brighter than it is today and have a radius over 100 times its current size. That's about as big a cross as the entire orbit of Earth. The sun will be so spread out that it'll have only a weak hold on its fluffy outer atmosphere. So soon, it'll start leaking much of its loosely held gas, creating a supercharged version of the sun's current solar wind. Exactly what this means for Earth depends on how the end of this red giant phase plays out. Some models predict that by 7.5 billion years in the future, the sun will have lost up to 30% of its mass. But it's still enormously huge. The ironic-sounding fact is, even as a red giant sheds its mass, it keeps getting bigger in radius and even more luminous. But its loss of mass will have some pretty serious consequences for the Metro Solar System neighborhood, because a less massive star will loosen its hold on the planets, causing their orbits to drift outward. If the sun loses enough mass, the Earth could migrate out fast enough to keep pace with the still-growing luminosity of the sun and not get totally incinerated. If it does, then the Earth stays pretty safe through the rest of the sun's evolution. But other models show that the tidal interactions between the Earth and the sun could create another effect, a slight bulge in the sun's atmosphere. If this tidal bulge is large enough, it'll slowly pull the Earth back in. And if that happens, our planet could be swallowed up by the atmosphere of the sun and just spiral farther and farther in until it vaporizes. And game over. But in yet another, perhaps more likely scenario, Earth will be able to stay out of the sun's atmosphere, but will still become so hot, up to several thousand Kelvin, that the entire planet will just melt and turn into a sloshing ball of molten rock. At this point, the sun still has more changes ahead, although it doesn't have a lot of time. In about 7.6 billion years, it'll undergo another dramatic but nearly immediate switch. It'll stop burning hydrogen in its shell and begin fusing helium in its core. This will happen in a near instantaneous event called the helium core flash, when the core temperature finally hits about 100 million Kelvin. This burst of energy restructures the entire inside of the sun in a cosmological blink of an eye, allowing the sun to start fusing helium into carbon and oxygen, which it has never done before. This helium burning phase will go on for about 100 million years until it goes through one last crazy growth spurt. By about 7.7 billion years from now, the core will be full of carbon and oxygen, which it can't generate enough heat to fuse. So it'll be forced to start fusing the remaining hydrogen outside its core into helium again, and then turning that helium into carbon and oxygen again. All this fusion will send the sun hurtling back upward in luminosity and radius, briefly becoming a red giant star one last time. But since its core temperatures will never push high enough to fuse the carbon and oxygen in its core, the sun's lifetime is basically over at the end of this second red giant phase, just over 7.7 billion years from now. The luminosity of the hot carbon and oxygen core will finally push off the small amounts of remaining hydrogen and helium, briefly creating an extended shroud of ionized gas called a planetary nebula. The naked core of the sun will have about half the mass it does now, compressed down to about the size of Earth. This is what we call a white dwarf, the remnants of a relatively low-mass star like the sun. As for Earth, if it managed to survive the red giant phase, in 7.7 billion years, it will be a smoldering cinder traveling around that white dwarf, which, because of its tiny size, will be too dim to keep Earth warm. Both the sun and any surviving planets will spend the rest of the lifetime of the universe cooling and fading. After their fiery finale, they will dwindle into cold obscurity. But hey, don't sell off all your stuff or quit your job or tell off your boss or anything, because we still have a good billion years ahead of us. So let's be sure to make the most of it.
It's one of the most beloved astronomical scenarios of kooks, con artists, and Hollywood producers. A planetary alignment, when the planets line up with the sun to form a sort of celestial Newton's cradle, and the laws of physics presumably use the solar system as a little plaything. You've probably seen this scenario in a movie or read one of the conspiracy theories online. The gravitation of the aligned planets would create a catastrophic force, causing earthquakes and tsunamis on Earth, throwing other planets out of their orbits, and probably other bad stuff. Well, obviously, this Mayan apocalypse version of events has never come to pass. But there are conflicting opinions about whether a true planetary alignment has ever happened. Some scientists think it just might not be possible, at least not precisely, because the planets don't travel on the same exact plane. It's true that most of them travel at roughly the same level as they orbit the sun, an area known as the ecliptic, but Mercury dips a little above and below that line. And Pluto is not a planet. But if we were making a sci-fi adventure movie in the 80s and we wanted to cast Pluto, its orbit is so rogue and weird it would never fall in line. Other astronomers, though, argue that in the 4.5 billion or so years that the planets have been around, they've probably fallen into a line at least a couple of times. The thing is, even though we have a pretty good handle on the planets' orbits, there doesn't seem to be a single agreed-upon calculation about how often all 8 of them would line up closely in 3 dimensions. To give you a sense of how hard it is for these 8 little ducks to fall in a row, it's kind of a big deal when the planets are simply all on the same side of the sun. That happened in March of 1982, for example, and a few hucksters managed to sell copies of their book by claiming a so-called Jupiter effect would cause all sorts of catastrophe on Earth, especially to poor California. Now, I wasn't born yet, but Hank was, and he's fine, so no Jupiter effect in 1982. In May of 2000, meanwhile, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn all happened to fall into the same slice of the solar system, about 25 degrees across, but we couldn't see it because they were all on the other side of the sun. Even if all the planets were to line up with the sun in true Hollywood fashion, nothing would happen to Earth. Space is big, and the planets are small and really far apart. The vast majority of the gravitational effect felt by Earth is from the moon and the sun. Everything else is negligible. We can look at it this way. The sun exerts less than half of the tidal force on the Earth that the moon does. And the next biggest object in the solar system, Jupiter, exerts only 0.001% of the force on us that the sun does. In 2000, NASA actually did the math and calculated that even if all of the planets and moons in the solar system were lined up precisely with Earth, it would exert enough extra gravitation to raise the ocean tides by 1/25 of 1 millimeter. Which I think could be an interesting movie, but definitely more a Terrence Malick than a Michael Bay. But you know what would be an amazing movie with at least some appeal? Syzygy, when 3 or more celestial bodies align. This is a lot more common because it involves fewer moving parts, so it's easier for us to predict and understand. Every time we can see a solar or lunar eclipse from Earth, that's a type of syzygy involving the sun, the moon, and our home planet. Which is swell, but there are practical applications too. In 1966, engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory discovered that Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune would align in syzygy 13 years later in 1979. So, NASA used that math to plot the course of the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft, allowing them to study all 4 planets as they pass by, giving us our best look yet at the outer solar system. Not only did a disaster not happen, but something really, really awesome happened. You guys would watch that movie, right?
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
And we're back. This next set is from Test Tube. I shall preface this first one about prisons by contrasting the current actions of our own Herr Hitler and his demands for more prisons, mandatory sentencing, and greater criminalization of life. In the US, it's big business. Methinks Harper hopes it will be so here as well pretty soon. Let's listen in.
With an estimated 2.4 million people behind bars, the United States reportedly incarcerates more people than any other country. According to a recent Supreme Court ruling, overcrowding is creating unsafe, unsanitary, and violent conditions, while medical and mental health care is being compromised. So how did we get here? Why are so many U.S. citizens in prison? Over the last 40 years, the prison population in the U.S. has risen by 700%. This is largely due to changes in drug sentencing laws that started in the 1970s. The zero-tolerance narcotic policies resulted in a dramatic increase in prison numbers. Nearly half of federal inmates and 16% of state inmates are locked up on drug-related charges. Long sentences and mandatory minimums are also a factor. Many states have variations on the three strikes law where repeat offenders automatically receive life sentences for their third felony. Rules have stayed in place despite studies showing that longer prison sentences and higher incarceration rates have little effect on reducing crime. These policies disproportionately affect minorities. According to the NAACP, about 58% of the male prison population is made up of African Americans and Hispanics, yet these minorities make up only a quarter of the American population. Racial minorities are more likely to be arrested and convicted, and once convicted, they often face harsher sentencing than their white counterparts. A more recent development affecting prison overcrowding has been the growing number of privatized institutions. For-profit companies now run many prisons in the U.S. These companies are typically contracted by the government on the strength of affirmations that they will uphold the rights and welfare of inmates, all while saving taxpayers' money. However, a 2013 report from the anti-privatization group In the Public Interest recently investigated these prison contracts. Out of a total of 62 contracts, more than half had quotas stating that prisons must have an 80 to 100% occupancy at all times. If the state and local governments fail to meet the quota, they often pay thousands, sometimes millions in taxpayer money for unused beds, which means it's in the state's interest to keep prisons full, regardless of whether or not crime rates are falling. According to the report, Louisiana, for example, is locked into prison contracts with some of the highest occupancy quotas in the country, earning the nickname of the world's prison capital. It's reported they have an incarceration rate nearly 5 times Iran's and 13 times China's. This is partially because in addition to private companies, Louisiana sheriffs are reportedly also profiting off of prisoners. In the early 1990s, the state encouraged sheriffs to build more local jails in order to reduce overcrowding. In return, they would receive cash incentives. Now, according to the Times-Picayune, there are more inmates in local jails than in state prisons, despite the fact that the state offers better reentry programs. Overcrowding has been exacerbated by the lack of a nationwide mental illness support system. The deinstitutionalization of mental health care in the 60s and 70s left many patients with nowhere to go. Now, more than half of the prison population is made up of those with a history of mental health problems. Most experts agree that major prison reforms are needed on a state and national level, and programs have attempted to rebalance drug sentencing laws. But as long as prisons are still working on a for-profit model, companies and states will benefit from arresting and detaining U.S. citizens.
We hear the word terrorism a lot, despite the fact that it is a term that is notoriously hard to explain. There is no international consensus on the definition, legally or academically, for the term terrorist. In fact, the U.S. government has more than 20 definitions for it. And in 1996, the UN formed its own ad hoc committee to draft an official explanation of the term, and that took 10 years. So what exactly constitutes terrorism? A mix of those definitions results in something like this. Terrorism is violence, or the threat of violence, against non-combatants or civilians, usually motivated by political, religious, or ideological beliefs. Outside of that broad definition, it might be better to explain terrorism by talking about what it's not. Terrorism is not organized crime. There are a few key differences. One is motivation. Terrorism is usually politically or socially motivated. Organized crime is profit motivated. Secondly, people in organized crime don't usually seek media attention, something terrorists do. Third, organized crime doesn't usually desire government recognition, unlike most terrorist groups. Terrorism is not violence carried out by one mentally ill person. This can be confusing because when it comes to violent acts, it's not immediately apparent who is sane and who is insane. For example, Mon Haron Monis took hostages in an Australian cafe in December 2014. He claimed that it was an official attack on Australia by the Islamic State. However, after the siege ended, many people, like the Australia Prime Minister, agreed that he was a mentally ill person and could not be considered a terrorist. Monis was killed in the siege, and his true intentions and affiliations remain unknown. Research shows that 40% of lone wolf attacks are perpetrated by mentally ill individuals. Terrorism is not violence perpetrated by a government against another nation. If a nation commits an act of violence, it is usually referred to as an act of war, or under certain circumstances, an act of self-defense. There are some exceptions to this rule. If a nation indirectly commits an act of terrorism by funding a terrorist organization or covertly organizing a terrorist act, that is still considered by some, like the United States, to be a terrorist action. Terrorism is also not an act of violence by a government against its own people. Nations like Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia had a history of terrorizing their own civilians, but those were generally considered to be acts of oppression or repression and not terrorism. These definitions are based on how the UN, the US, and many international scholars interpret these terms. If you disagree or have a dissenting opinion, you're not alone. As we said at the top of this, terrorism is notoriously hard to define and often used to mean many different things by pundits, politicians, and the media.
Measles, a disease that was declared eliminated in the U.S. in the year 2000, is now at the center of an outbreak at Disneyland in California. More than 50 people have been infected with measles there, and the outbreak has sparked fresh calls for parents to vaccinate their children. In 2013, Reuters reported that almost half of babies and toddlers were not receiving their recommended vaccinations on time. The question is, why are some parents foregoing vaccinations, and how will this affect the population in general? The Centers for Disease Control, the organization tasked with limiting the spread of disease in the U.S., recommends that all Americans receive vaccination shots for various diseases. No federal law exists forcing parents to vaccinate their children, but all 50 states require vaccinations for children entering public schools. However, a large number of states allow parents to opt out of these vaccinations. In some states, it's as easy as signing a piece of paper. Why are these parents opting out? Well, children with weakened immune systems or other medical conditions should not receive some vaccinations without a doctor's recommendation. Those that are part of a culture or religion that tends to be against vaccinations, like some Amish or Hasidic communities, also choose to opt out. Other children, primarily from low-income households, simply slip through the cracks because their parents don't have the time, money, or access needed to vaccinate them. Then there are some parents who fear their children will develop autism or have other severe reactions to the shot. This belief stems from a 1998 study linking autism to vaccinations, a study that has since been discredited and retracted in 2010. The CDC, citing several studies, completely rejects the claim of vaccines causing autism. Still, the myth persists. Also, there are indications that a section of parents in the well-educated middle class choose to delay the shots because they're concerned that the government's one vaccine schedule fits all approach isn't right for their child. Still, this population is relatively new and has not been fully studied as of yet. So why does this matter? It matters because there is evidence that people who are not vaccinated against certain diseases, like measles or whooping cough, are not only endangering themselves, but also endangering the vaccinated majority. When fewer people are vaccinated for diseases, the chances that even vaccinated people will be infected goes up. This is because no vaccine is 100% effective. The immunity of large groups, which is known as herd immunity, only fully works in an environment with high vaccination rates. When the majority of a group of people is immune to a disease, that disease is less likely to spread far, even among non-vaccinated people. Herd immunity serves as a vital buffer to babies who are too young and other people who are too sick to be vaccinated. If herd immunity dips below 90% for diseases like measles or whooping cough, larger outbreaks occur, and that's exactly what's been happening now as more parents refuse to vaccinate their children. Ultimately, the choice to vaccinate yourself or your child is up to you, but we urge you to get all of the facts before you consider not vaccinating your child. You can find the links to the studies we used below, including the CDC link urging you to vaccinate your child.
The terms Sunnis and Shiites get thrown around a lot when discussing Middle Eastern conflicts. Sometimes it's useful, but most of the time, it feels like it's just shorthand for these people hate each other. But with over 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, there's no way they can all be involved in some Hatfields and McCoy-style blood feud. So what's really going on here? Well, first of all, not all Sunnis and Shiites are at war with each other. There are tons of places where they coexist peacefully, like the United Arab Emirates or Dearborn, Michigan, for example. It's also worth noting that their religions aren't diametrically opposed. In fact, the Sunni-Shiite conflict isn't even really about religion. It's about power. Originally, Muslims were all one group, unified under the Prophet Muhammad. Then, in the year 632, Muhammad died, and Muslims split off into two separate groups. The Sunnis wanted Muhammad's successor to be chosen by his community of followers, while the Shiites wanted the leadership to stay within the Prophet's family. The Sunnis were in the majority, so they chose their new leader to be the Caliph, which is basically the head of state. The Shiites did not recognize this new leader, and instead, they chose Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali, as their new imam, which also basically means head of state. That was the main source of divide, and from there, things really only got worse. Early on, most of the Shiite imams met violent ends at the hands of the stronger Sunni caliphs, including Imam Ali's son, Hussein, whose beheading is still considered a major holiday for Shiite Muslims. Today, there are numerous Sunni and Shiite militant groups, terrorist organizations, and oppressive governments. Being Sunni or Shiite doesn't necessarily make you a member or even a supporter of those groups, but they're still divided up that way. In fact, every nation with Sunni-Shiite conflicts has large militant groups on both sides, and they all have a history of oppressing one another depending on who's currently in power. Iraq, for example, was run by an oppressive Shiite regime before Saddam, then an oppressive Sunni regime under Saddam, followed by an oppressive Shiite regime once again after Saddam left power. Now the oppressive Sunni militant group ISIS is threatening to take over huge parts of the country. So you can see that the Sunni-Shiite conflicts are more about power, politics, and retribution than actual religion. And truthfully, the words Sunni and Shiite aren't even the best words to use when discussing Sunni-Shiite conflicts. They are way too general. If you're talking about militant jihadists or terrorist networks, but what you really mean is ISIS or Al-Qaeda, just say ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Otherwise, you're including billions of people who aren't even involved and most likely don't share the beliefs of those fringe organizations. If you'd like to learn more interesting information about the world, click now to see our video about the lethal injection debate and why it should matter to all of us.
Recently, two American men attempted a coup d'etat in Gambia to overthrow the government there. This attempt was unsuccessful. The failed attack is one of about five supposed coups attempted in 2014. The question is, how many of these were actual coups and how many were just rebellions? First, we have to talk about the difference between a rebellion and a coup. The word coup implies a quick power shift that is not approved by the political process or the general populace. A small group literally takes power without the consent of the people. Rebellions are power shifts brought on by a popular mandate of the people. It's the result of the masses removing or replacing a government or its leaders. In 2014, in both Abkhazia and Burkina Faso, the heads of state were forcibly removed from power. Those heads of states claimed that this was done in a coup, but according to experts, that claim is more of a political play than a reality. In both cases, angry protesters stormed the government buildings and forced leaders to give up power and leave, making the incident a rebellion instead of a coup d'etat. The ousted leaders are claiming that these were coups because coups are less respected by other nations compared to rebellions and easier to overturn. For example, historically, U.S. law only allowed aid to be sent to countries reeling from rebellion, but not coups. The same thing happened following the Ukrainian Revolution of 2014. Ousted President Yanukovych cried coup when he was unseated by parliament, even though there was an actual vote. Yanukovych still says the vote was illegitimate and the final step in a coup d'etat. Sometimes the line between coup and not coup is harder to define. In Lesotho, in August, a military action forced the prime minister to flee, but he was able to return a week later, and no one in the army ever officially took power of the country. The army claims that the leader's own police force was going to stage an armed rebellion and that he was forced out of the country for his own protection. The prime minister rejects this claim and has called the action a coup, but it's hard to clearly define the intentions of everyone involved. The most successful and clear-cut case of a coup d'etat in 2014 happened in Thailand, but that is nothing new. NPR estimates that more than a dozen coups have been attempted there since 1932. Thai coups are unique mostly because they are bloodless and happen frequently for an otherwise flourishing nation. The military there is lawfully allowed to seize control of the country during political turmoil, so as long as the coup is successful, it is legal and the King of Thailand will officially recognize the new government.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
We shall close this week with a special guest rant from Rick Mercer and a set from It's Okay to Be Smart with Deja Vu. There is no cold. Deja Vu. Why don't clouds fall to the ground? And lastly, Deja Vu. Sorry, did we do this one already? Let's listen in.
There's nothing I hate more than those situations where the more I read, the more confused I become. Welcome to the Canadian economy. 5 minutes ago, the government was crystal clear. It was all about the oil. It was practically government policy that every firstborn child in Canada should become a pipe fitter. And if anyone dared suggest that our economy was too dependent on oil, they were nothing less than an enemy of the state. And now, the price of oil has tanked, the world is dumping our currency, and the Prime Minister is showing up in Ontario of all places talking about manufacturing. Yes, Alberta, I hate to break it to you, but Big Daddy's flirting around Eastern Canada saying, oil, schmoil, I barely knew her. Give him another week, he'll be admitting he was born and raised in Toronto. This is why I am so confused. The Bank of Canada says low oil is very bad for Canada, all of Canada, and yet the government is saying there are tax breaks for the wealthy coming and everything is on budget. But oh, wait. There is no budget. How can there be no budget? You know why there's no budget? Because behind the dull eyes of the finance minister is a brain melting in full-blown panic. Look, I lived in Newfoundland before the collapse of the fishery. I understand how upset people in Alberta are, but one thing we know is no matter what happens, we will get through this together. As sure as the sun will rise, the sun will set, and there are very expensive commercials on TV paid for by us telling us, wait for it, our economy is the envy of the world.
It is currently -1 degrees Celsius. It is raining, and I am cold. Really, really cold. At least I think I am. Technically speaking, there's no such thing as cold. It's not a substance. You can't literally feel cold. It doesn't float around in the air around us. When you touch something frigid, there's nothing called cold in there. It's what isn't there that really matters.
Matter. It makes up air, ice, human beings, everything. It's composed of atoms, and no matter how solid something feels, those atoms are jiggling around like crazy. Temperature is really a measure of all that jiggling, the kinetic energy of anything's atoms. The scale of that temperature ranges from lead ions smashed in the Large Hadron Collider to 5.5 trillion Kelvin to absolute zero, the point where all atomic jiggling stops. Thing is, when the mercury plummets, we don't actually feel the temperature. We feel the flow of energy. We feel the heat.
Feel my heat.
Or really, we feel the unheat, because cold can never move into something. It's heat flowing out. There's three ways that energy is transferred. Conduction is the transfer of heat between solid objects, convection uses the movement of fluids, while radiation relies on electromagnetic waves. The sensation of being cold is really just energy moving from one temperature to another, causing our matter to jiggle a little bit less, and the matter around us to jiggle a little bit more. It's just like when a rubber ball gives up some of its energy every time it bounces, eventually coming to a stop. The universe steals energy from us and keeps it for itself. It's very greedy, that universe. So which is hotter, a boiling tea kettle or an iceberg? The kettle, obviously, right? Put a thermometer in both and boiling water will register higher. But the iceberg contains more heat, more thermal energy. I mean, think about it. If I drop them both in a swimming pool of ultra-cold liquid nitrogen, which would warm up the pool more? It's not the tea kettle, I'll tell you that much. Once we leave Earth, it gets even more complicated. We think of space as a vacuum, but it isn't completely empty. If we collected a cubic meter of deep, deep space, say between two galaxies, we might only count 100 atoms. And if you were floating out there, you'd freeze almost instantly. But if we measure those atoms, they might be at temperatures up to 1,000,000 Kelvin. That's because temperature doesn't depend on the number of jiggling atoms we're counting, 100 or 100 trillion, just their average kinetic energy. If we put a thermometer out there, it wouldn't read anything. There's just not enough matter to matter. So if temperature is all about kinetic energy, why does a wind on a cold day make us feel even colder? Shouldn't the air be moving faster and be hotter? On the smallest scales, the atoms and molecules in the air and in our skin are actually jiggling so fast already that adding a little wind doesn't make any difference. So my atoms are jiggling however fast they do at normal body temperature, and the atoms in the winter air are jiggling slower. My atoms bump into the air's less jiggly atoms and transfer some vibration. I lose heat and feel cold. When a wind comes along, it brings in a fresh batch of less jiggly air, and I give up even more of my heat. It's the same reason that blowing on a cup of tea causes it to cool down. Heat transfer is why a tile floor feels colder than the carpet, because it's denser. There's more atoms packed closer together, ready to steal your precious warm vibrations. It's why you'll freeze to death faster in cold water than in snow. It's why you can put your hand in a hot oven, but touching a hot pan will burn you. And it's why you should never, ever touch your tongue to a frozen flagpole, even if someone triple dog dares you. Really, we feel cold because it's the law, the second law to be exact. We feel cold because the universe is on a long, slow mission to even everything out, increasing entropy, lowering energy, until the whole universe is at equilibrium. Life is about the opposite. All our inner chemistry and biology is a way to hold on to energy, to keep it for ourselves and do interesting things with it. That's cool. Stay curious. Psychologist Endel Tulving said, remembering is mental time travel.
So a latte for Joe?
Oh, thanks. Remembering is one of the greatest powers that we possess. The ability to learn from our past, to return to where we've been, so we can decide where we're going. But can we return to where we've never been?
So a latte for Joe?
Yeah. Thanks. Could have sworn I just... Is it me or does this seem familiar? I feel like I've seen this before.
Oh, man.
Or as the French would say, déjà vu. As many as 90% of us will experience déjà vu during our lives, mainly in our teens and 20s, and almost never before age 8 or 9. Déjà vu isn't a physical phenomenon we can pinpoint in a brain scan. It's a feeling, and not one that we totally understand. But we've got a few theories. Our memories aren't exact copies that we just write once and then store like files on a computer or pictures in a box under our bed. Remembering is really more like reliving. Our brains are constantly scanning our senses to determine if what we're experiencing is familiar. And once we label a stimulus as familiar, a different brain region called the hippocampus recalls the memory associated with it, refiring the neural circuits that hold that piece of our past, and we live the experience again in our minds. If these steps get out of sync, if something is deemed familiar but we fail to recall the context, that could be déjà vu. But that doesn't explain why we feel déjà vu for experiences that are truly unfamiliar, or why we don't experience it for every familiar thing.
So a latte for Joe?
Yep. We don't realize how hard our brains work behind the scenes, filtering our environment, Gesundheit, unconsciously determining if what we experience is new until it doesn't work.
Oh, man.
Our various sensory inputs, smells, sounds, sights, are normally processed and mixed together as one event. Another déjà vu theory says if one of those stimuli is recorded out of sync, the late arriving information could be flagged as a different event, which makes it feel as if it's happened before. Or it could be a malfunction in how memories are made in the first place. Normally, new experiences stop off in our short-term memory before being written into long-term storage. Skip the first, and it could feel like we're recalling new events as old ones. Or perhaps when we focus on one part of our environment, the rest of our world drifts to the unconscious. And when we snap back to reality, it feels like we've been there before, because we have, just now. These feelings of misplaced familiarity are familiar to us, but the what, the where, and the why of déjà vu remain unknown.
So a latte for
Got it, thanks. All in all, there's dozens of plausible explanations for it, and maybe more than one is right. Bless you. There's no neat answer, but no mind or memory is perfect. The only way we'll get to the bottom of déjà vu is to experience it all over again. People have been looking at clouds since people have been people. Those billowing shapes might have been our first art or the characters in our first stories. And we still love to pick out shapes like bears, fish, flying saucers, faces, elephants. Some clouds even fly through the sky like airplanes. Which is weird because clouds are full of so much water that they can easily weigh as much as a jumbo jet. So why don't they fall out of the sky? There's lots of different kinds of clouds, but in the most general, weathery terms, clouds are big, fluffy piles of water vapor that live overhead. As warm, humid air rises through the lower atmosphere, it expands, cools, and some of it condenses into very tiny liquid droplets. And so a cloud is born. Just how that water vapor rises, though, depends on the type of cloud. If the wind pushes it up a mountain like it's on a ski jump, we might get lenticular clouds. Humid jet engine exhaust can make wispy cirrus clouds. But maybe the easiest cloud to understand is everyone's favorite fluff ball, cumulus. They're also the easiest ones to draw. It's a cloud. So how do you keep the weight of 100 elephants in the air? Buoyancy. Warm air is less dense, so it rises, just like inside of a lava lamp. Cumulus clouds appear over dark pavement, fires, sunny hillsides, any source of warm updrafts. As the water vapor in that air is carried up, it cools, so its molecules slow down and some of them stick together, forming droplets that we can see. We still have an unanswered question, though. After the wind carries them away from the warm updraft, why don't clouds fall back down? Because of condensation. You know how when sweat evaporates off your forehead you feel cooler? That's because water moving from liquid to gas takes some heat with it. Condensation is just the opposite. It releases heat. So as the water in a cloud condenses, it heats itself from the inside, staying aloft like a hot air balloon. Da Vinci called them bodies without surface, which is why we can't live on them. But maybe in them. Lieutenant Colonel William Rankin did just that. Accidentally, anyway. As he was piloting his fighter jet over the top of a massive cumulonimbus cloud, the engine caught on fire. He ejected and fell from 47,000 feet straight into a 9-mile tower of lightning, thunder, ice, rain, carried up on 70-mile-per-hour updrafts and barely conscious. He was suffering from frostbite, bloodied by the pressure change, bruised by hail and drowned by rain. What should have been a 10-minute parachute ride down to the ground instead took him 40 minutes. He was definitely not on Cloud 9. He was in it. In the 1896 edition of the International Cloud Atlas, cumulonimbus, the world's tallest and most powerful clouds, were placed at entry number 9. Unlucky pilots aren't the only living things inside clouds. Scientists found that living airborne bacteria make up as much as 20% of cloud condensation nuclei. Not only are they home to airborne ecosystems, clouds are in some ways very much alive and evolving themselves. Just take a few minutes and stare up at a fluffy cumulus as its edges billow and die. The rain that falls from them will one day rise to become new clouds. It's very circle of life. It might be because they're so alive that their names sound like biological species. Cirrocumulus stratiformis, Cumulonimbus capillatus incus. Actually, those sound like Harry Potter spells. Undulatus aspiratus. The greatest cloud photo of all time wasn't taken looking up at the clouds, but looking down on them. When Apollo 17 astronauts brought this image back to Earth, it became the symbol of a new environmental movement demanding an appreciation of our fragile planet. 29% of its surface covered by land, 71% covered in liquid water, but so many clouds. There's a lot that scientists still don't know about clouds, but they are definitely important. And they look cool. Like Gavin Prater-Pinney says, they are nature's poetry writ large for all to see. I mean, what's a sunset without clouds? It's just a disappearing circle. Plain blue sky is just boring. Clouds are what puts the pale in this pale blue dot. I like that.
Well, that's all we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
To make an apple pie from scratch. host first. Invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
Ocean, border,